Coming up next on Art Focus, the Portland Art Museum's curator of modern and contemporary art talks about the new exhibit of drawings and paintings from artist Richard Diebenkorn. All of this morning's KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Happy birthday!
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 years of KBOO. The exhibit was created to relay our history and demonstrate the importance of community radio, featuring archival photographs and ephemera collected from KBOO's 5 decades of broadcasting. The exhibit tells our story in our members' own collective words. Our online tour features highlights from the exhibit and companion audio clips to enrich visitors' experiences. The exhibit runs until July 29th at the Oregon Historical Society at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information and audio clips can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Sarah Krajewski. She's a curator of modern and contemporary art at the Portland Art Museum, and she's here to talk about Richard Diebenkorn Beginnings, 1942 to 1955, which runs now at the Portland Art Museum through September 23rd. Thanks for coming back into KBOO, Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to talk about this exhibition with you.
Yeah, so Richard Diebenkorn, a modernist, mm-hmm. and that's about all some people know about him. Born in Portland, but not really known here.
Right.
And this shows his early work, so it runs up to when he was 33.
Mm-hmm.
So just tell us, in brief, who he was and where he fits into the canon of American modernism and world modernism.
Sure. Diebenkorn is generally considered one of California's best-known abstract painters. He worked from just after World War II up until his death in the late 90s. We think of his career in terms of three different periods. The early work is created in an abstract expressionist mode, a lot of non-objective abstraction. He was always a great colorist. Then in about 1955-56, he transitioned into working with the figure, and for about 10 years, which are now known to art historians as the Berkeley figurative years, because he was living and working in Berkeley, California. And then in the late 60s, he returns to abstraction, and the dominant series that he made at that time was called Ocean Park. And he moved to Southern California at that time and lived in the Ocean Park neighborhood of Santa Monica. And the light and the atmosphere of that environment really influenced these quite beautiful, colorful, but very flat, abstract, geometric canvases that he made.
So if one were to find one of his paintings in London or New York or Chicago in a big museum, are they likely to be Ocean Park? Is that what he's known for?
Yeah, that's really what he is known for. And the exhibition allows viewers to get a sense of his trajectory up to that point. There's hints around his approach and his process and the kind of reduction to the canvas, to pure color and form and plane that we see in these very famous Ocean Park series of works.
Mm-hmm. So the show is put together, the curator is Scott Shields. And tell us how you worked with Scott.
Sure. Scott Shields is the chief curator and deputy director at the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento. The exhibition is drawn largely from the Diebenkorn Foundation. So Scott was instrumental in working with the director of the foundation in sourcing the work. It's important that to recognize that a lot of this work hasn't been seen by the public before because it's been held privately. It was all kept by the artist and his family. And then when he passed away, it moved into the foundation. So Scott was instrumental in bringing out this roughly 100 works for public consumption. He's also written a fabulous catalog, which you can get at the museum. You can see it in the exhibition space as well as our gift shop.
That's a big coffee table book.
Yeah, and it's really, I think, a lovely biographical source on Diebenkorn's early career. So if you're someone who loves a story of an artist and how they developed, not only the catalog will be will appeal to you, but hopefully the exhibition as well.
So it begins when he's very young. I mean, he's 20, right?
He's doing
kind of student work.
Yeah, this is another unique aspect of this exhibition is that it goes much further back than other maybe quote-unquote early Diebenkorn exhibitions. It starts when he was attending Stanford as a youngster. And Diebenkorn grew up in a middle-class family, so it was expected he would study probably anything other than art when he went to Stanford.
He'd be a businessman or a lawyer or something.
Yeah, in a profession. And so he was pursuing art courses on the side. And the exhibition opens with three examples of what we might think of as student work, but which is already very sophisticated and shows how much Diebenkorn was looking at the work of other artists. That's a thread that we'll experience throughout the exhibition, just how many different artists were influential to him. There's a lovely watercolor of rooftops outside of Sausalito, and Scott Shields, the curator of the exhibition, has pointed out how much of an echo that has with the work of Edward Hopper, who was a social realist artist painting these kinds of haunting American landscapes. So Diebenkorn would have been familiar with that work and the work of other artists working in that social realist mode at the time.
Do you think he would have known Hopper from like magazines or from actually seeing it?
Exactly. I think that in that case, it was through magazines or posters. There's an anecdote that one of Hopper's famous paintings was hanging in reproduction in the art department at Stanford. So he would have been aware of kind of the general kind of compositions and subject matters that these artists were exploring.
Mm-hmm. Do you think at that time, you know, who else was hot right then? I mean, Picasso. Like, it was the war.
Mm-hmm.
It's odd to think what influences a 20-year-old, you know, is it the art of 80 years before or of 2 years before?
Yeah, I think in the case of Diebenkorn, it was a combination of all of those. He would have been very much aware of the popular art of the day, that of Edward Hopper and others. But he was also had the opportunity to see the work of European modernists. In particular, he went with one of his professors to the home of Sarah Stein, who's related to Gertrude and Leo Stein, the famous expatriate collectors and supporters of Picasso and other artists in Paris. And in her collection, he would have seen a beautiful Matisse painting. And Henri Matisse becomes a touchstone for him throughout his career. Matisse's approach to abstraction, to color, to pattern, and those things made a big impact on him as a young student artist.
Mm-hmm. So when he gets going, he is a professional painter fairly early on. He's making sales.
Yes, by the time he goes through the war, he serves in the military. That's another formative experience for him. Once he comes out of the military and he's taking advantage of the GI Bill,
Was he abroad during the war?
Well, no, he didn't actually see any active duty. Well, I guess I'm not sure. He wasn't in the theater of war, per se. He actually really bristled under the authority of the military and got into a bit of an altercation with a commanding officer, in which he was demoted back down to private, which in Diebenkorn's own words, he thought that was really might have saved his life, because then he stayed on bases within the United States. The furthest he got away from home was in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And there are actually some really lovely watercolors that he made during his time on bases in Hawaii, where there's the military buildings are in the foreground, and the lush landscape, the mountains and the greenery of Hawaii is seen behind mm-hmm. it.
And also some sketches of military, you know, officers and fellow soldiers.
Yes, he, Diebenkorn, even as a kid, was always drawing, was always making illustrations. And I don't think he thought of himself as an artist at that point in his life, but it's just something that he did. So during his military years, I think he was very opportunistic in taking advantage of moments where he could make a sketch. There's some lovely drawings of his peers, one of a sleeping officer on a train, and a nice little inscription by in Diebenkorn's own hand describing the figure. He was on the East Coast at this time, so Diebenkorn is he was born in Portland and moved to the Bay Area at a young age, really a kind of California kid. His military service does take him to the East Coast for basic training, and being in Virginia, he is able to go up to Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York, and go to the major museums there. And it's at that time that he's really becoming immersed in ideas around what the avant-garde from Europe and the United States were doing at the time, how Picasso and Baroque, the Cubists, were fracturing the picture plane, how the Surrealists were exploring dream imagery. And we see that in this work from the mid-40s, where he's really experimenting with these different styles, different ways of organizing his compositions, and really kind of rapidly moving through these experiments and taking little bits and pieces from each and making it into his mm-hmm. own artistic language.
You've got one called Untitled Magician's Table.
Yes. Yeah, that one, Diebenkorn was really involved in a lot of conversations. This is after the war, and he goes to the California School of Fine Arts in San Francisco. And it's a very progressive art school, and all of the students and professors there are talking about abstraction and non-objective abstraction. But Diebenkorn, he can't quite fully divorce himself from reality. The work you've mentioned, Magician's Table, it almost looks like a kind of cubist still life sitting on a table, but the forms are suggestive of that kind of genre, but really broken down into the planes, and it's a very flat abstraction, but also very colorful reds and blues. And this importance of color in Diebenkorn's work is something you can see throughout his career, from these early days all the way up to his famous Ocean Park paintings.
Mm-hmm. So he was making it really as a painter, but what was his— He was teaching art at the same time, correct?
Right. So right out of the war, he is a student at the CSFA for a year. And then, like many other GIs returning home, there's a huge influx of students to the school. So the next year, he's appointed as an instructor, as a teacher. So right away, he is getting recognition for his talent, and begins to teach. He starts to get some success pretty early on, being recognized with major exhibitions and with gallery representation. So he's even by 1948, with a major exhibition he has in San Francisco, being recognized by the critics as California's leading abstract painter.
So he was making collages, you know, cut up paper. What are some of the better ones you have in the show?
Sure. There's a small section of collages that I just absolutely love. They're small compositions utilizing cut paper, ink, gouache, watercolor. And I find them really unusual in Diebenkorn's career. It's not something we associate with this grand abstract painter, are these small intimate collages. Collage was a technique at the time that was really favored by surrealists as a way to kind of detach maybe some of the intellectual aspects of making art and responding more automatically to materials and to color and to form.
Mm-hmm. And to chance.
And to chance, exactly. There's one collage in the exhibition that I absolutely love. It has a small detail of a drop of ink that hit the paper and then spread out and absorbed into the paper. And Diebenkorn uses that as an opportunity to build the composition from there. So on top of this dark ink splot, you have a circle of purple and then a little bit of yellow paper on it. And then the composition kind of radiates out from that one point. So I think the collages represent just how much this young artist was really experimenting and trying to find his own artistic voice.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Sarah Krajewski. She's the curator of modern and contemporary art at the Portland Art Museum, and she's talking about Richard Diebenkorn Beginnings, which covers 1942 to 1955, and it's on now through September 23rd. So Diebenkorn, I'm curious to know whether he was influenced academically, like it was an intellectual thing, I must explore all these new things happening, or whether he was, you know, like a beatnik, he was just taking it all in and expressing himself. Can you tell that in this early phase of his life?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think Diebenkorn is an artist who had such an innate ability to use material and to he was a great colorist. There was a lot of things that I think came rather easily for him as an artist. So on one level, he was absorbing all that was happening around him, and it kind of channeled through his talents and his abilities onto the canvas or onto the page. But I think he was also very engaged in the conversations at the time, which were trying, this is post-World War II, this is the time of the abstract expressionists, and how the conversations were really about abstraction being the current form, the current artistic expression, that it could do something that representing reality or depicting the figure couldn't do at this particularly kind of turbulent moment just after the war. So all of Diebenkorn's peers, his instructors at this time, this is 1946, 47, and 48, were engaged in these conversations. And one of the important figures at that moment at the California School of Fine Arts, where he was a student and then a teacher, was the abstract expressionist Clifford Still. Still comes in to be an instructor at the school, and he's a big personality, making big, dark paintings, really very strong, gestural, very large canvases. So all of the students, including Diebenkorn and the faculty too, have to measure themselves up against this like kind of larger-than-life figure. And I think one way that Diebenkorn really does set himself apart is this exploration of color. Still's canvases are quite dark and quite heavy, and Diebenkorn uses a lot of yellows, a lot of blues, and even though at the time his canvases are quite small, the forms are rather totemic within them, kind of reliance on the color that he was experiencing in the work of European modernists like Matisse was really coming through. So he was always struggling to set himself apart. And I think this exhibition really, and actually Diebenkorn's own story, it's one of this notion of modernist progression in art, that here's an artist who has to measure himself up against his peers and his and those who just his predecessors, those that just came before, and then innovate on it and make this move forward, this progression.
And his career, I mean, he had to work, he had to teach, and that his career moves him around and that influences art. But so after his Bay Area period, he goes to, where does he go?
He goes to New Mexico. One remarkable part of this exhibition is it's all happening very fast. So by 1950, he has been in the Bay Area now for several years, and things are just getting a little bit too comfortable for him. There's a great story of how he and a friend named Hassel Smith, another abstract painter, could start to finish each other's canvases. And so they're having exhibitions together, and that's not the direction he wants to take. So he decides to go to graduate school, actually. So he's still very young in his career, and goes to the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
To study
painting. He had been to the Southwest a couple of times as a younger person and was really drawn to the openness of the landscape and the colors of the land, the quality of the light. And those attractions are something that we kind of see throughout his career, that he was, even though he tried to be a non-objective painter, always this influence of environment, of place, does factor into the choices and decisions he's making as an artist.
Are there any good New Mexico period pieces in the show?
Yeah, actually, some of the largest canvases that are in the exhibition are from this particular period. One of the interesting anecdotes from this time is that he takes his first commercial airline flight, and he's able to see the landscape from up above, and the way that viewpoint flattens, and you see the patterns below you. So there are a couple of paintings in the exhibition where you really get a sense of that kind of looking at something from up above, including this beautiful kind of orange, red, gray composition that's, I don't know, almost 7 feet tall. It's called Untitled, yeah. Like many
Thanks
of the works in the exhibition. Untitled.
Is it on the big wall?
There's another piece, too, that just precedes that. That's a wonderful yellow composition. That one's called Untitled Albuquerque. So okay. He gives you a little bit of a hint now and then to the place that's influenced him. But both of those paintings have incorporate large areas of color and bright color with borders created by darker colors, black or gray or a deeper hue of red, to suggest this kinds of segmenting of space, segmenting of the landscape that I think was a reference to that experience of seeing the landscape from up above in the plane.
So he's still a young man. He's still a student, really, you know, doing his master's. But he's also, is he known in the art world?
Yes, he is. So at this moment, even though he's in graduate school, he's got a very active studio practice. He's making something like 50 paintings a year and has a gallery in, I believe it's in Los Angeles. And he really can't make paintings fast enough for them.
Oh, wow.
He's really being recognized as one of the leading artists from California, leading artists nationally. So he's included in a lot of exhibitions at the time as well. Mm-hmm. And he's also in conversation with figures from New York. Some of the big names from this moment are the critic Clement Greenberg, who was a major advocate for the abstract expressionists, writing about their work. And
do you think any of the Greenberg paintings that come to Portland are by Diebenkorn?
Oh,
did he collect him, I guess?
I don't know if he did. The Portland Art Museum has a number of paintings in our collection that were part of Clement Greenberg's collection, and we don't have a Diebenkorn painting in that grouping. But Diebenkorn was reading Greenberg's writings and how Greenberg would describe kind of ultimate role of painting was just to be what it was, a flat surface that contained paint and line, that it wasn't a window into another world. Mm-hmm. So all of the abstract expressionists were kind of in these conversations around how to represent this kind of essentialism in painting.
Mm-hmm. And then he took another turn geographically. Where did he go?
Yeah, so after he graduates from the University of New Mexico, he decides to take a teaching position at the University of Illinois in Urbana. And a couple of things, he's not there very long. I think it was less than a year he spent there. He was hired to teach more technical drawing, and once you come to see the exhibition, you will see that this is an artist who's really much more interested in broad brushes of color and a little bit more loose drawing style. And so, you know, it's clearly not a good fit. He's not not suited to that kind of teaching.
Is he teaching like engineering drawing or?
Yeah, architects, this kind of drafting, I guess we would call it. And also the landscape in the Midwest, it's just not a good fit for him. I think one of the important things to note about Diebenkorn is just how much light and how much color in the surrounding world influenced his way of painting. And so the landscape there just didn't quite, he just didn't gel with it. He does make a pretty significant shift while he's there in Urbana in that year of 1953 and 54. And he starts to think about incorporating the figure more specifically in his paintings again. So for somebody who had tried to get rid of all reference to the figure, to still life, to that this objective reality, this was a pretty significant mm-hmm. Shift for him.
So, I mean, this is a show of his early days, and it kind of ends with a couple of big pieces, Urbana and Urbana II. The latter is subtitled The Archer.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at them, you know, we can actually see someone with a bow and arrow.
Right.
So things are starting to come back.
Yeah, this is significant for Diebenkorn I think for a couple of reasons. This painting looks like one of his abstractions. It's got a big block of green, a big block of blue, and this kind of I guess drawing element that he uses darker colors or a black paint to carve out parts of the composition. But in this case, that drawing is referencing a very kind of basic rendition of a figure kneeling with a bow drawn. For Diebenkorn, he was always looking at art history as well as his peers and what they were doing. So this work has a direct reference to images of cave painting that he was looking at the time. And I think he might have been drawn to those images. Part of the conversation these artists were having at the time was about, for lack of a better term, a kind of primitive approach to rendering the figure. So another artist that would have been really important for him at this moment was Willem de Kooning. De Kooning made his famous Woman One work at just a year or two before this moment. So he was introducing this way of making introducing the figure into the abstract expressionist canvas, using these kind of strong gestural marks, describing the figure just through these kind of very expressionistic, linear strokes of the brush on the canvas. And so Diebenkorn would have been aware of how influential de Kooning was in bringing the figure back into this essentially non-objective painting style. So for Diebenkorn, I think this approach of looking to art history to find other ways to describe the human form within the canvas kind of met this a nice intersection with what his what other artists were doing at the time.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Sarah Krajewski. She's the curator of modern and contemporary art at the Portland Art Museum. She's been talking about Richard Diebenkorn beginnings, 1942 to 1955, and that show runs now through September 23rd. Thanks very much for coming back to KBOO.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Onion Music Festival starting July 28th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space in Washougal, Washington. The Onion Music Festival features a three-day lineup of musicians, artists, installations, and vendors. Performers include the fabulous Downey Brothers, The Fur Coat, Night Heron, Adebisi, and many more. This is an 18 and over event with no dogs allowed. Again, that's the Onion Music Festival, July 28th and 29th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space, 30303 Northeast 10th Street in Washougal, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO has a tent set up at the Occupy Ice encampment in southwest Portland, where we are broadcasting and webcasting live reports from the camp.
Protesters have created a community of resistance since June 17th. To protest the deportation and separation of families by the U.S.
U.S. Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.